consumer choose whether he wants to sue or accept arbitration voluntarily.
Now, I understand there's also a rule being considered by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Do you know anything about that? Can you speak to what impact that could have?
The CFPB is looking at proposing, in fact, is getting ready to finalize a proposed rule that would basically eliminate forced arbitration clauses in consumer credit agreements, like credit cards and that sort of thing. And this would be a great progress for the consumer. This is something that the Chamber of Commerce and pro-business Republicans have tried to stop in Congress, but I would argue that they should support Obama's Consumer Protection Board on this one, because Congress itself authorized this. Basically, it's moving away from the federal law that got us into this mess, the Arbitration Act of 1925. So what CFPB is doing, I think, is going in the right direction.
Well, I've been speaking with Dean Clancy. He's a conservative, a former White House and congressional staffer. And Mr. Clancy, thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
And the time is 6 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland. All right. Thanks for tuning in.
President Obama visits a federal prison. There's a call to federal prosecutors to lessen the use of mandatory minimums. There's bipartisan congressional support for reform. Tune in to Prison Pipeline to hear national leader Van Jones, who believes now is the time to end the mass incarceration industry in America. That's Prison Pipeline, November 9th at 6:30 p.m.
And the first one now will later be last, for the times, they are a-changin'.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And this program has also been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from RadioCab. Serving the metro area since 1946, with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, RadioCab offers airport service, wheelchair-accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212 in Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or radiocab.net.
Today on Wings, we start with Shakespeare's England.
Welcome to LGBTQ Art. This is Ashley, and today I am here with Stacey Villalobos, who is one of the founders of the Portland-based queer Latina art collective, Pochas Radicales. Pochas Radicales will be on a funding creativity panel next week on November 15th at Kennedy School as part of the Siren Nation Festival workshops. The Siren Nation Festival starts tomorrow and goes through November 15th. You can find out more at sirennation.org. Potus Radicales has a Facebook page. It can be found at facebook.com or just by Googling them as well. So thank you so much, Stacey, for coming down and talking to me today.
Yeah, of course.
It's really great to have you. Can you first, I guess we'll talk a little bit about yourself first and then get into the art collective. How did you get involved with the arts?
I started thinking about this before high school in a ways that I think I started doing art because it was a way for me to talk about the things that I saw around in my environment that I didn't like or that were really oppressive for me. And I guess like kind of like trying to look at the foundation of it, it goes to like mental illness and mental therapy. So I remember in second grade, this is like the best memory I have for this explanation is that I drew my parents as the devil.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Yeah. And I did it in class. And so obviously my instructor saw it and called my parents to come, down to school. And I was like super freaked out that I was going to get punished or whatever. And they came back and they were just smiling and laughing. And I was like, oh, that's weird. Thinking Spanish, like, ¿qué pasa? And they're like, you know what? Our teacher like showed us what you drew and we're not mad at you. She actually said that we should probably push you to do more art because it seems like that's like a really healthy way for you to let out your emotions and just questions you have about the world around you. And I think that's what led me to do art. It's just the way for me to heal maybe from like inherited trauma from things that I was seeing in society that I didn't understand as a kid.
Right. Yeah. What kinds of things did you feel like you needed to process? Like what types of traumas are you referring to specifically?
Yeah, I mean, I think now I'm thinking like historical trauma, from like ancestors, colonization, and also within my own upbringing, around what it means to what masculinity means, and also I grew up in a household of 11 people.
Wow.
So I have 6 brothers and a dad and 2 sisters and a mom. And wow. So just, it's a lot of masculine energy around there. Right. And I grew up in a mostly traditional Catholic family. And even though my parents weren't super fanatics, that was still something that was totally ingrained in my culture and my upbringing.
Did you, were you raised with relatively traditional gender roles presented in your family? Or was it a little bit more acceptable to be more masculine because there was energy around?
Yeah. I think it was more acceptable. Like I was definitely a tomboy growing up. Like my parents would, buy me boys' pants. My brothers would give me their skateboards. Yeah. Dad would invite me over to the skate parks to record them. And so, those gender roles weren't really there, but I still saw them.
Right.
I still saw how it affected my mom, how it affected my aunts and my cousins. And so it was just really subtle. It wasn't really in like, yeah, it was just really subtle for me. Yeah.
Definitely. So you said that you started out drawing pictures of devils, things like that. Is that still your main medium is drawing? Or do you do other types of art as well?
Yeah. I think therapeutically, I tend to do more drawings. I think it's a way for me to focus my energy and to just kind of shut off everything around me. But what I mostly love to do, and I think it's because of my dad, is I love to storytell. So what I've been doing around Portland since moving up here in 2010 has been performance art. And within that usually means that I'm, just talking to people, just telling a story in a bilingual way. So I'll mix Spanish and English. I'll code switch in between. Sometimes I'll tell the same story, but only if you're bilingual in both those languages will you understand what I'm excluding and what I'm including.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. What types of stories do you tell with those performances?
Looking back now, usually it has to do with relationships, like how I relate to others, the structures and dynamics of power within relationships and partnerships of any kind, like intimate ones, friendships, like business partners or your colleagues, your coworkers, and also thinking like more macro, like my relationship to the government, my relationship to the nonprofit that I work at,
Absolutely.
And also just, my relationship to what it means to be someone living as that has been historically colonized, but also has had the potential and probably has had the possibility of also colonizing other folks, you know, right. in microaggressions in those kind of ways, you know,
being able to recognize what you're doing. Absolutely. I feel like that's a really big part of the art that we make sometimes is realizing those things about ourselves.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting. How would you say that your personal identity influences your art?
My personal identity, I think, is that being really flexible and fluid within my, you know, I identify as a queer cis, a woman of color, like Chicana, Pocha, and mm-hmm. Pocha, for folks that don't know what that term is in a way a fake-ass Mexican, fake Mexican, sorry.
Yeah.
So someone that's not authentically American, right? American standards, and someone that's not authentically Mexican. Mm-hmm. So someone that has been assimilated to a certain extent, but is also resisting that. And mm-hmm. so someone that lives in between those worlds. Yeah.
Okay.
And so I think that when taking those identities, those intersectionalities, and then looking at the work that I do, definitely going back to what I said, code switching, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know what it means to be authentically Mexican. I don't. I also don't know what it really means to be a citizen of the U.S.
Right.
So, like, I feel like that's really important for me to reach out to my community and say, like, you know, we're not rare. We're not, like, you know, we're not just one. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of us, and we need to find ways to connect with one another. Because I feel that the more connections we have with one another, the more ways that we can reach vulnerability, the more space we have and resources we have to heal ourselves.
Definitely. Do you find any challenges in regard to your personal identity relating to your art? I mean, is it something that you can kind of freely express, or are there any challenges that brings to you?
I think sometimes, especially like in an academic institution, feeling very tokenized, mm-hmm. and you know, coming on like, oh, like this is Blanca Stacy, like she's Chicana. Oh, okay, you're gonna dress up like Frida Kahlo, and you're gonna make sugar skulls, or you're gonna draw like these like awesome Aztec figures.
Right.
And so I think it's like, well, I get that, and I also embrace that part of my culture, but that's not necessarily the kind of art that I will do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes like all, you know, our little logo is their Virgen de Guadalupe dressed up as the ICP member drinking Faygo.
Right.
And so that in a way could be called Chicano art,
right?
Because I'm using, pulling images from my culture to talk about other subcultures in the United States.
Right.
Yeah.
That's great. Who are some of your artistic influences?
You know, and like, the musical ones come up first. Definitely Violeta Parra. Mm-hmm. She was a Chilena feminist radical, and definitely, you know, Ana Mendieta, who's a Cuban artist who did a lot of land art with her body, who, you know, who's, you know, both of those women, their deaths were really tragic, and you know, one of them committed suicide, and the other one had a really weird death, where people think that she committed suicide, but there was this weird, it's really skeptical about Russell, her husband, like, it, you know, again, this this idea of like masculinity always invading women's bodies, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, so mm-hmm. Definitely those two figures have been influential to me, and all of my family members, they're all really creative. I know some of them probably wouldn't consider themselves artists, but my younger sister is a beautiful writer. My brothers work, you know, especially my dad, they work with their hands. My mom, she's a comedian. She makes everyone laugh. You know, she releases all the stress that all 11 of us hold sometimes. Yeah.
Right. Where are you from originally?
Southern California.
Okay.
Right on the outskirts of the Inland Empire, for anyone that's down there, like the 909.
Awesome.
Yeah, but I grew up closer to the desert, so like Joshua Tree, Palm Springs, than LA.
Awesome. Do you find that, I mean, obviously it's pretty different up here from down there, but I guess in the art world and maybe some of the influences with, I guess, the landscape there versus the landscape here, mm-hmm. does that really affect your art that much?
Like in terms of the environment,
just
you mean?
The place, being there and being here.
Oh yeah. I moved up here when I was 23, mm-hmm. and before that, I mean, I knew that I looked brown and people perceived me as a Mexican, but that wasn't a priority for me. It wasn't like a constant conversation that I was having every day. Mm-hmm. And when I moved up here, that's what happened. Mm-hmm. Everyone, like without me having to think about it, everyone had to know what I was.
Okay.
You know, not even who, like where, you know, my history, like my story, mm-hmm. but like, what are you?
So people ask you, what are you?
Yeah, like, well,
race-wise.
You know, race-wise, yeah. Like, where are you from? Like, you know, they'll kind of take this long route to try to figure out where exactly, like, it doesn't make sense that you're here, because right. Portland, this area, is very white, and you're very much ambiguously brown.
Right.
So, you know, for my first year, it was having to constantly think about those questions, because I had never really been asked that, and I decided, you know, if people are going to consistently be asking me this, I don't want them to tell my story. I want to tell my own story. I want to tell where I'm from and who I am.
Right. Well, I guess that leads into my next question. Can you tell me a little bit about Poetras Radicales, your art collective? How did that get started? And what inspired, I guess, the catalyst for this group?
Yeah, again, you know, my very unique experience here in Portland, in that I went to Portland State University. I went there and I double majored in art and Spanish. I mm-hmm. Was heavily involved with a lot of student groups, especially with Las Mujeres at PSU, as a feminist woman of color, specifically Latina group. And then also with Time Arts Club, with a little bit with Mecha. But even then, I came up here not knowing anybody from, you know, down in Southern California. So obviously I wanted to seek out these other like folks of color.
Yeah.
Because I felt very much alone. And even in the spaces, even in the art department, even in my Spanish class, I just felt like I couldn't really connect with anybody. And that was because I was also queer. And so, again, going around that feeling of also being tokenized was like, you know, well, Stacey's the queer Latina that we know. So we want her to speak, you know, for that community. And I just, sometimes I felt okay doing that, but other times I didn't. And mm-hmm. so I decided to write down these questions and write down my thoughts online on Tumblr and on a blog. Because it just felt more safe for me to do that online first. And also there was a huge resource of skills, of ideas, of curriculum online. Like mm-hmm. so many people are on there sharing with one another. It's so great. And like, you don't have to, you can be anonymous. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to, and that's a way of being safe also.
Right.
And so I started off a blog first and I got that going. And then that was also around the time where I was reclaiming the word bocha, mm-hmm. because growing up, that was a negative term. That was kind of like, you know, being queer, where right. we're reclaiming that word.
Right.
To feel empowered.
Right.
And so it was around the same time where I was starting this blog that I was reclaiming this word for myself. And then I started meeting these wonderful women in my life that also identified as Latina and as queer. And, you know, through like constant conversations with them, building a relationship, a friendship with them, you know, feeling comfortable sharing and being vulnerable with them. I was already doing performance art on my own and trying to get myself involved in the arts in Portland, that I decided, you know, why don't we make a collective? Why don't we do things together? You know, I get really stoked when people want to collaborate with me. So obviously I started reaching out to these women asking, yeah. Hey, do you want to do a performance with me? Do you want to write a story or a poem? And these women didn't consider themselves artists. And again, it's that intimidation of what art means, especially in Portland, you know.
Yeah.
I remember Kenya Perez Correa, who was a member last year, said that every time she's, you know, heard of art or saw the word art, she just constantly thought of the big A, capital A art. You
yeah.
know, it's like this space that historically, you know, doesn't really welcome folks of color. Mm-hmm. You know, and the gallery spaces they're also white. So, you know,
yeah.
symbolically too.
Literally.
Yeah, literally. And so, so I started talking to her, and then Sue met another woman whose name is W. Kibler Hidalgo. Mm-hmm. And they're both, right? They both work in nonprofits. They do amazing work, and they're both very creative people. And we just started having conversations, making food together, very good, this very informal informal way of doing art in a way that's not intimidating, in a way where we can talk about our intersectionalities in a safe way and also be able to challenge one another. And that's one of our goals and our missions in the collective, is that we need to be able to challenge all communities, even the ones that we belong to, you know, because that's, we're always learning and unlearning, even within ourselves, like talking about, like, you know, holding this identity that's been colonized, but also could colonize, you know?
Right.
As a way of decolonizing ourselves.
Right. That's incredible.
And so, yeah, those women, they're still around in Portland and doing amazing work, and they've been great mentors for me as well. And the exciting thing is that now we have two other women who are part of the collective. They are Andrea Tellez and Elizabeth León. Mm-hmm. And I met them similar ways. Elizabeth, I knew for about a year, and Andrea constantly, when she found out that I was actually moving out of Portland back in May, but I came back, obviously. Mm-hmm. But she was just like so stoked at this kind of collective existed,
right,
that she just reached out, and we were able to connect over the summer, and now she's a part of the group, and she's helping out, and she has a lot to offer.
That's great. Do you guys do regular performances? Like, is it, you know, like every month we do this, or every couple months? Is it like a scheduled thing, or mm-hmm. is it just kind of when someone has an idea and everyone's kind of inspired by it? How does that work?
Well, so since Andrea and Ellie came on board, I want to say like middle September, early October, we haven't done like work. We've mm-hmm. we've applied for like grants and mm-hmm. applied for like workshops, and those things are coming, but they haven't actually happened yet.
Right.
So I can talk to last year when I was with Kibler and Genya, where maybe every other month we would get invited to do a talk at PSU about mm-hmm. the collective, about mm-hmm. the work we do. And then we were invited by some folks that got together, organized as a Latino art festival for women called Fuse Me. So Sofia Costa was one of them, and she invited us on board. And so it was, I want to say last year was more, we had more invitations
right.
than us actually trying to get these things going. And I think that was good for us. Like, you know, really new collective, kind of taking it easy, because we all had 9-to-5 jobs.
Yeah.
It's trying to find a balance. So it worked out to have people come seek us out than trying to do all these things at once, you know, because we were also learning how to function as a collective, how to process our work. But now it's been us doing a lot of the work. We're like, we want to do this. You want to hold workshops. You want to perform. You want to do installations. So that's what we're in the process of doing right now. We submitted a grant to the Precipice Fund through PICA, and so we're mm-hmm. hoping to wait back from that.
Yeah.
And then I, you know, obviously I met you online. Yeah. Because like, you put out a post about, you know, women of color artists doing work in Portland. And I was like, yes, that's us.
That's me.
Yeah. I want to make us visible.
Of course.
And that's I think, like, my role as founder and, like, sort of, like, facilitator, mediator. Just, like, I just want to make us, and not just us, but our community as well, visible in the Portland metro area. And, like, yeah.
So do you, I mean, it sounds like you had a lot of people that were super supportive in the first year of the art collective. Do you feel like your experience would be different in another city, like in Southern California? Would this collective have even come to fruition? Would it need to exist there? Or mm-hmm. is it more that it needed to exist here to facilitate this type of art from this community? I mean, does that make sense? Like, do you feel like you're providing a platform that people are really supportive of, that you might not need to elsewhere if those opportunities just existed?
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I would have been able to do all of this if I would have stayed in Southern California.
Okay.
I mean, the Latino population is huge over there, but I mean, they obviously are all, like, they're still struggling, they're still trying, mm-hmm. they're still resisting, they're still working and building community out down there. But I think just my personal experience here, you know, cultivated that need,
mm-hmm.
not just for me, because like I mentioned, I met other women who also felt like there was a space that was lacking in Portland. And I felt like I had enough, maybe resources, skills, or experience to be able to organize and network those people and say, like, this is what I have to offer. And I know you have so many things to offer as well. And maybe you're just not aware of them, or mm-hmm. you feel like if you have some intimidation, or you know, a lot of us, you know, especially myself, sometimes lack self-confidence, again, going back to like being women, being mm-hmm. passive and submissive, and also with that being Latina mm-hmm. too, like how we're seen from, you know, from like a white gaze, right?
Right, for sure.
And but in terms of this being able to exist in other places, I think it could. I've talked with past members and present members about how it's a time and place specific collective.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, depending on my location, that's where the collective will go.
Mm-hmm.
But I also want to be able to sustain something with it. And so, you know, even though Kenya and Kilbert aren't present, like active members, you know, their sources, they are resources for Andrea and Ellie and myself still now too.
Right.
Yeah.
That's great. So do you feel that there are still voids in the Portland art community that need to be filled for certain communities, or do you think that it's pretty supportive no matter what type of art that you're making or what type of artist you are?
I definitely think there's a lot that needs to happen in the art community in Portland. I think folks of color, you know, there's tons of artists of color doing work, but I don't know a lot of them. I don't know mm-hmm. a lot of them. And I also don't know many gallery owners or curators that are of color. And so I feel like there's still this invisibility happening in Portland, but that doesn't mean that there aren't people already working on that and making work. I just think thinking historically of Portland and being a white city, and that maybe there's an either like a lack of maybe from like our allies that maybe haven't come to us mm-hmm. more often to ask us, like, what are your needs?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are your needs? How can we help you? Like, what kind of spaces do you require? What kind of skills do you want to build on? I think that hasn't happened enough.
Right.
And people are constantly trying to build coalition with one another. And I see that a lot, especially with the Black Lives Matter
mm-hmm.
movement going on here. And, you know, I feel like in the art community, you know, again, there are folks doing work, but we're so scattered sometimes
right.
that it's hard to connect with one another.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And also, you know, figuring out like how do we come together and cultivate something and sustain it, even though we know that there's so many barriers, so many challenges that we face already.
Like, right.
You know, in our daily lives.
Right.
You know, and then we're trying to now form a group, you know, support from one another, you know.
Right. Well, do you find that it becomes a supportive group just in general for you, not just to your art, but like you were saying, I mean, the vulnerabilities and telling your stories and sharing those experiences that you've probably all had to get, you know, like having a dialogue. Do you feel like it's a good resource for you just in your life in general?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, I feel like even if I have my family up here, it's so nice if, like, for me personally, it's so nice to just see someone that I can share culture with, like language with, shared experiences with, and just to feel like I'm not by myself and that the challenges that I face aren't just unique to me.
Right.
You know, it's definitely like, it's like, I feel like it's a huge like a sigh of relief when I meet someone, and yeah, they're doing awesome work, but I was like, I just like to see other folks of color.
Right.
And I want to be there for them. I want to, you know, offer what resources I have. I want to connect them with other folks.
Right.
And I think other people can, I think that resonates with other folks of color here in Portland, creative, you know, whether they think of themselves as artists or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's definitely a very healing space to be in.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
And it could be like two of us in a room or like 50 of us. Yeah. Yeah.
Either way, you're still going to get something out of it.
Yeah.
So do you guys have anything coming up that you want people to know about or any projects that are in the works?
Yeah. So I just heard from one of the organizers for the Oregon Students of Color Conference. It's happening the weekend of the 14th of mm-hmm. November at mm-hmm. Portland State University. So we are doing a workshop and I'm like blanking on the title right now, but it's basically, the title is I Belong in This Space, People of Color Navigating Art Spaces.
Excellent.
And so we're doing a workshop on Saturday. It's either going to be in the morning or towards the afternoon. And so you don't have to be a person of color to register for the conference or attend, but there are workshops that are closed just for allies, or they're open for everyone, mm-hmm. or they're closed just for folks that identify as people of color.
That's great.
So we're going to be doing that workshop there, and it's going to be a tour of galleries on campus, and then also an activity where we're going to be taking portraits of people and having them do some really radical things with their portraits around town.
What is that called again? Where was that from?
Oh, yeah. So it's part of the Oregon Student to Color Conference.
Great.
At Portland State University during the weekend of November 13th, 14th, and 15th. So Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Very good.
It's a great conference. I've been there twice. I've gone twice before, and you just meet so many wonderful people doing so much good work.
Right.
In the state of Oregon.
Excellent. That is so great. Well, that is all the time we have for you today. I appreciate you so much for coming down. Thank you so much.
And thank you.
Like I said, Poetress Radicales is on Facebook. She will, the whole collective, the whole board will be at the Siren Nation Festival Workshop Funding Creativity Panel on November 15th. You can find out more at sirennation.org.
ideas about witches. The choices are dizzying, so we've called it Witch Witch.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
I like the Wicked Witch of the West. What I liked about her in the film was that she was allowed to be so extreme and hysterical. She was like a kind of demented version of Joan Crawford.
And this screaming voice, Surrender Dorothy!
What used to be this repressed spinster on a bicycle, who can now suddenly ride cackling on a broomstick through the sky and plot the deaths of innocent children.
Witch Witch, produced and presented by Mindy Ran.
Thrice the branded cat hath mewed.
Thrice and once the hedge pig whined.
Harpier cries, tis time.
Around about the cauldron go, in the poisoned entrails throw.
Double, toil and trouble. Fire burn and cauldron bubble.
Fillet of a fenny snake in the cauldron boil and bake. Eye of newt and toe of frog, wool of bat and tongue of dog. Adder's fork and blind worm sting, lizard's leg and howlet's wing. For a charm of powerful trouble, like a hell broth boil and bubble.
And if you look closely at the cauldron scene, which is the scene people are apt to remember from that play, it's very ghoulish. They're throwing in all kinds of horrible things. But it also has this playground quality, like great big chunks of greasy, grimy gopher's guts, this sort of element of think of the ickiest thing you can. Not exactly a big joke, but not mega serious either.
Shakespeare's three witches in Macbeth have given us some of the most enduring representations of the witch as old hag. But, according to witch historian and lecturer at Oxford, Dr. Diane Perkis, perhaps he meant them to be seen entirely differently than they are often represented today.
If we're talking about England, in the period when witchcraft was still a capital crime, there were really two kinds of representations of witches. Serious ones and funny ones. Witches were also a kind of joke, a kind of learned joke, because nobody really believed in them, or learned people didn't really believe in them. So there's a witchcraft trial in Lancashire in 1633 that's represented as a puppet show that tours the country, rather like Punch and Judy, and there are witches going, wah, 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 and other witches going, wah, 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 witches fighting in the air on their broomsticks. There were stage plays, which were kind of knockabout. And you couldn't say it was favourable to women, but it wasn't dreadfully earnest and afraid either. What it comes from is that increasingly sophisticated people who've been to school, been to university, don't really believe in witchcraft anymore. And they regard it as something that only plebs believe in, only village clods believe in. So the joke is really on anybody who'd be stupid enough to believe this stuff. Even Shakespeare's witches, who by the 19th century are regarded as very serious and are therefore staged very seriously by everybody now. So if you saw the last Royal Shakespeare Company production, they're very earnest. They don't have to be like that. They could be like witches in pantomime. They could all come on doing Knees Up Mother Brown or something like that to try to bring to a modern audience that sense of sort of rural comedy and presenting something you don't quite believe in yourself.
If Shakespeare isn't the more serious version of that time, who is?
Professional demonologists, serious writers on demonology, which is like a little academic specialization that you can go into in the 16th and 17th centuries. What those people work on is how old women in villages can possibly have any supernatural powers. And that's what they find scary. I mean, they're learned guys with university degrees. And they're confronted by a world in which they believe elderly women have the power to, for example, sink the ship that the king's sailing back to Scotland in. And they find that a very scary thought. So the way they rationalize it is, women don't have any power, no power at all. All their power comes from the devil, who of course is a guy. So though all these books sort of have witch on the cover, if you like, you don't actually learn very much about witches.
12, bewitching the said William Hutsoon with an evil spirit, which continued with him for 26 weeks and left as soon as he was taken into... And the sermon being ended, he came down and took the said John by the hand and led him wildersinis about, and thereafter caused him kiss his ass.
The way we modern historians have learned about those witches is a kind of third source that I guess straddles the division between serious and funny, and that's pamphlets based on the witchcraft trials, which are a kind of early equivalent of newspapers, I guess, like the National Enquirer or the News of the World that isn't very reliable. That's what these pamphlets are. And they're great trials of our time. Mother style, the witch of Wantage. And then you get 6 or 7 pages summarising what everybody said in court and what the judge said.
Embarked in a boat beside Robert Grierson's house and sailed over the sea to a tryst they had with another witch, where they entered a ship and drank good wine and ale in it, thereafter causing the ship to sink with the persons in it, then returned home.
They tell us what this woman's actually supposed to have done. And it's usually a list of events that would seem to a modern person totally trivial. Why on earth would any of this be punishable by death? She killed my chickens. My pig got sick. Sometimes the person will be accused of what it legally was called murder by witchcraft, and then they'll be accused usually of killing a child, which obviously is more serious.
16. Chased cat in Tranent. Because at a convention held at Brumhoylis, Satan commanded all present to catch cats. Fourthly, he dismembered the bodies of dead corpses and specially unbaptized children. Fifthly, he destroyed men by land and sea with corn, cattle, and goods, and raised tempest and stormy weather as the devil himself, blowing in the air, etc.
And then usually there's a couple of pages explaining the moral meaning of the case. Thus we see how this woman, by her dreadful adherence to the Catholic faith and Romish doctrines, came to part from the ways of godliness and to fall into the snares of the devil. And thus we see that she finished on the scaffold, and then there'll be an account of how she behaved on the scaffold, whether she was polite and repentant like you're supposed to be. 16. It almost gets to the stage by the 1670s and 1680s where nobody who's learned enough to write this stuff down can understand the basis for it.
Where are women in society at this point?
Where women are is in a completely secondary, rights-free position. That's not to say that they're not respected or that everybody hates them either. There's not a lot of misogyny because, in a sense, patriarchy is fairly complacent. But women's role is pretty much defined in terms of being head of a household, being in charge of food production, being in charge of managing the affairs of the household, being a mother. And what a witch does is inverts those roles. Instead of making food, witches destroy food. They kill your chickens and pig instead of fostering them. In exactly the same way, instead of fostering children, witches kill children. So they are an exact reflection, but an inverted reflection of what women in this period are meant to be doing and are meant to be for.
Anne Laveau is a magical worker who has been studying and practicing witchcraft since the age of 14.
You see in society two parts of magic. You have magic as a product of luxury, when people are rich enough and don't have anything to do in daily life. They start thinking about things that make their life interesting. So that's how the cards we use today, the tarot cards, originally were developed by the rich ladies in the castles in Italy. At the other side, you have magic as a way of surviving. And this starts in a society when people become outcasts. And it's not especially women, as nowadays is told in those gorgeous romantic stories, but there were just all the people who were different, who were too short, too crazy, or they were something like transgender or gay. They were not banished, but they become outcast at the edge of the village. And there they needed to survive one way or another that fit with how people saw them and that was fitting for their place at the edge of society, because someone who lived there couldn't have a bakery or a store in the village. So those people became artists. They became the ones who started playing theater, and they also began to practice witchcraft because they were seen as something supernatural, because people were very superstitious. So if you were too long, you were a giant, and if you were too short, you were a dwarf. And when you had a strange thing in your looks, well, then maybe you were a changeling and the fairies had replaced the original baby. So this superstition was used. You were already something supernatural, so you start using the supernatural.
Anne Laveau also identifies as transgender, both male and female, and believes this was part of her path to the craft.
In older cultures, transgender was also seen as something supernatural. You just saw someone who was a bridge between the world of the male and the world of the female. So the idea of that this person also makes a bridge between the visible and the invisible world is easy made. Because if you really have a strong balance in yourself between the male and the female, it gives you a lot of skills. So a transgender, a two-spirited one, as called in some ancient cultures, has abilities that can be easily used for magical tradition, for craft.
What happens in between the late 17th century and the mid-19th century is that the skeptical, comical witch gradually comes to triumph more and more over any popular views of village witchcraft. Witchcraft's taken off the statute books in 1707, ceases to be a crime at all. Popular witchcraft beliefs do go on in villages. In fact, there's a lynching in a village later in the 19th century, in 1893, in a Warwickshire village. So it's not that those beliefs die out, but they cease to have any elite recognition whatsoever. What happens in the middle of the 19th century is that there's a completely new kind of representation of witchcraft. And instead of seeing witches as either deluded old women or in the power of the devil, a new kind of witch is created, and this is the enchantress. The witch who is glamorous, exciting, beautiful, young, with serious magical whammy, and can be either good or bad. Now, this is a literary creation, and it comes from medievalism. It comes from people reading medieval romances and being attracted to a certain kind of figure in them, abstracting that figure from context and turning it into a Victorian icon of seductive, semi-nude, occult power and glamour.
Where moves there any beautiful as I, safe with the little golden greedy carp, gold unto gold, a gleam in its long hair, my image yonder? Oh, my beautiful, what roseate fingers! Some fierce magician flies or walks beyond the gateway, by the sentries now, close and more close, I feel him in my heart, some great one. No, I hear the wavering steps without there of a little light old man. I dreamt some great one. Oh, my beautiful, what roseate fingers.
The play you just heard, Yeats' Time and the Witch Vivian, is a good example of just how seductive the whole idea of otherworldliness had become. Unlike the idea of magic and the occult in the previous centuries, this time it was the intellectuals and artists that dived headfirst into the cauldron, giving rise to a whole new representation of witches.
Well, I think this new strong sexual enchantress is totally a product of the changing position of women in those societies. It comes from what you might call the aesthetic radicals of the era. Initially, it's a male sexual fantasy, but it's a male sexual fantasy that's appropriated for the whole cult of the new woman, which is both a male fantasy and then is picked up by the feminist movement and turned into a female fantasy. That's what happens to the enchantress. She starts out as something that men do for themselves and finishes up as something that someone like Georgie Yates, Yates's wife, can inhabit also in an empowering way to deal with what would otherwise be the impossible situation in her marriage, where Yates went to into a word she says unless she's doing spirit talking. So obviously you then do spirit talking. But as you can see from that story, it's also a way of avoiding confrontation. Rather than saying, for God's sake, William, why don't you ever listen to what I'm saying? You produce all this spirit talk and spirit writing to get him to listen to you without having to confront him. And that's what the enchantress does in the late 19th, early 20th century occult movement. They're finding a way to work around it, to bring together the empowerment that feminism's offering to all women without the drawbacks, without the direct confrontation with lords and masters that might otherwise be involved. So she's a way of imagining yourself as a woman to be very, very powerful and mighty and defeating the foe without actually having to, for example, make your way to Oxford or Cambridge. Another kind of enchantress that's around at this time is spiritualist mediums who can make the dead appear as ectoplasmic forms by breathing out ectoplasm through their mouths and can speak in the personae of the dead. And there are many famous ones. You have them to your dinner party. There are also lots of female fortune tellers, especially gypsy fortune tellers. The most famous is one called Gypsy Rose Lee, who really did exist and who, again, was a kind of fashionable, almost tourist attraction in late 19th century London. But what you've also got moving through into the 20th century is women moving into these occult movements and to some extent making them their own or making them part of their movement towards feminism or empowerment. Probably the best examples of that are the women in Gerald Gardner's First Coven. It's a very man-run thing, Gerald Gardner's First Coven, but it does include at least two women, and they subsequently write books about the occult. And that follows through then into post-war witchcraft in general.
Gerald Gardner chose the word witch as a rebellion, but it was not very serious, I think. It was really about being proud that you did what you want.
These eight words the Wiccan read fulfill, and harm ye none, do what ye will.
I don't think that witch maybe is a real word for what is happening in reality. There are theories, the word comes from the German word Wicca, and it has to do with the word wise. But in fact, as I studied, I saw that it was a bad translation when the Bible was translated in English, and the Hebrew word was in fact someone who makes poisons. So witch is originally someone who makes poisons and poisons people.
Most pagan rituals these days are done in people's living rooms, and they're done in people's living rooms because most witches live in towns or cities.
When the wheel begins to turn, soon ye Beltane fires will burn. When the wheel hath turned a yule, light the log the horned one rules.
The perceived connection to nature that neo-paganism offers is really for people in cities who don't have as big a garden as they'd like. A friend of mine who's a witch calls us all living room witches because they don't actually live in tiny villages in which they can wallow out onto the moors and go into the stone circles. And the whole movement is in part a response to urbanization. In that sense, it's an outgrowth of romanticism. So you've got this situation where the less people know about nature, the more fascinated they are by it and the more seduced they are by its power and the more eager they are to aggregate that power to themselves.
I see a lot of people calling themselves witches, while they have really no idea about what being a witch is and what witchcraft is. In the 90s, you had the big trend of witchcraft and paganism, and there is now really a mixture between paganism and witchcraft, and people really don't understand what the difference is. Paganism is a way of life and it's a religion. If you want to believe in some pagan gods or goddesses and you want to worship nature and you want to celebrate the festivals of the year, well, that's cool. Everyone can do that. But not everyone who is a pagan can be a witch.
What is required?
Don't be bound by the rules from the world around you. And that is also where magic starts. A big difference between spiritual parts and witchcraft or magic is we don't do ethics. When you read a book about witchcraft, one of the first things you shall find is that more than witchcraft is about nature. We are talking about natural magic. Well, natural magic is not bound by human culture. Ethics and morals and laws are made by man and not by nature.
I think most neo-paganism is fueled by fiction rather than by books by people like Starhawk or Vivian Crowley or someone of that sort. If I talk to pagans, one of the things I always ask them is, what have you read that really inspired you? And one of the things they nearly always say is Marion Bradley's The Mists of Avalon. It's a feminist rewriting of the Arthuriad. Now, it purports to historical accuracy. I'll refer you to a medievalist for a detailed critique, but it nevertheless inspires pagans with a notion of what it's like to be a powerful enchantress. And it's all about incredible power to do amazing magical spells that transform the landscape, essentially. So you can make islands appear where they weren't, or there are hidden islands that you can make appear by doing spells. And that's very seductive because it suggests that you have access to a sort of mystical version of Britain that nobody else can see.
At last, the day when I was cast out of Avalon, clad only in my shift and unarmed, save for the little dagger of a priestess, to return if I could. I knew that if I did not, they would mourn me as one dead, but the gates would never again be opened to me unless I could bid them open at my own will and command. And when the mists closed around me, I wandered long on the shores of the alien lake, hearing only the bells and the doleful chanting of the monks. And at last I broke through the mists and called upon her, my feet upon the earth and my head among the stars, stretching from horizon to horizon, and cried aloud the great word of power. And the mists parted, and I saw before me the same sunlit shore where the lady had brought me 7 years before, and I set my feet on the solid earth of my own home.
It goes along with a whole fantasy literature in which there are very powerful enchantresses who rush around. Some of them are evil, some of them are good. It's a romance tradition. It's pretty pulpy. That doesn't make it bad, but it's pretty pulpy. And it's pretty much indebted to a hippie version of what constitutes good living or good life.
Perhaps it is not such a coincidence that the writings of J.K. Rowling brought her into the good life. Rowling is the creator of the Harry Potter series, set in the Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry.
History of magic was the dullest subject on their timetable. Professor Binns, who taught it, was their only ghost teacher. He'd been speaking for half an hour when something happened that had never happened before. Hermione put up her hand. Professor Binns, glancing up in the middle of a deadly dull lecture on the International Warlock Convention of 1289, looked amazed. Granger, Professor, I was wondering if you could tell us anything about the Chamber of Secrets, said Hermione in a clear voice. Professor Binns blinked. My subject is history of magic, he said in his dry, wheezy voice. I deal with facts, Miss Granger, not myths and legends.
We can find all these tensions and strains reduplicated in children's literature. For example, Harry Potter contains many representations of witchcraft, mostly positive. Most of the witches in Harry Potter, most of the people called by the word witch, are good characters. Hermione Granger is good. Professor McGonagall is good. Nevertheless, as you doubtless know, Harry Potter is the most frequently cited book on banned lists in the States. It's now displaced Huck Finn, which used to have the pole position, largely by people who believe it to be Satanism. And if you look at Amazon.com, you'll find several books published by authors who believe that Harry Potter is introducing kids to the power of Satan.
Which has so many interpretations, I don't think it's easy to work with a word like witch. You know, pagans and other people are using the word, a lot of charlatans, and still you have the very, very negative interpretation of people in Africa who are called a witch. So just call it what it is. I work with magic, so I'm a magical worker.
So you're still a little bit on the outside of the village.
Well, the famous old saying about being a witch is, who cannot hex cannot heal.
I think there is a median position held by most witches themselves, which is where their power comes from nature. And I think probably quite a lot of people might sort of half thoughtlessly assent to that, or half thoughtlessly say there might be something in it in an agnostic spirit. But I think if they really thought there was a lot in it, they'd be alarmed rather than enthusiastic. I mean, if witches were really levitating the Pentagon now, particularly now, actually, I think people would be nervous. I don't think they would be pleased. And I think that's just as true now as it was in 1600.
When shall we three meet again? In thunder, lightning, or in rain? When the hurly-burly's done, when the battle's lost and won.
That will be ere the set of the sun.
I'll wear the place.
Upon the heath.
There to meet with Macbeth.
I come, Grey Malkin.
Calls anon. Fair is foul, and foul is fair. Hover through the fog, and filthy